This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents All These Worlds, Bobiverse Book 3. Written by Dennis E. Taylor. Performed by Ray Porter.
For Bill Paxton, who brought a little more humanity to some great SF movies. Dedication. To my wife, Laheen, for being okay to travel this path with me. Especially the part where I retire to write full time. I leave eternity to thee, for what is man that he should live out the lifetime of his God? Herman Melville. 1. Face Off. Bob, March 22-24, Delta Eridani. The pigoid erupted from its lair with an angry squeal. It displayed startling speed for something with such short legs. The two rock throwers sprinted to the side, fur erect along their spines and ears sticking straight out in excitement. The rest of us set the butts of our spears into the ground and braced them with a foot, and waited. This time, I wasn't an observer. If I had been nervous before, I was terrified now. I could feel the fur standing up along my spine and all the way up to the top of my head. I kept telling myself that I was actually 10,000 miles away, in orbit. Didn't help. My eyes told me the pigoid was 10 meters away, charging at me at what appeared to be about half light speed. Then the animal ran into the spear points. Still not breeding for intelligence, apparently. The spears bowed, but held, and the animal slammed to the ground with a final squawk. Bernie sidled up to it and poked it in the face a few times. Getting no response, he waved his spear in the air and yelled, "Woo!" The rest of us raised a fist and responded, "Ha!" Well, that's how the translation routine handled it. Delton's speech sounded more like pigs loudly wallowing, but the software converted everything to human equivalents for me, including names and colloquialisms. Donald slapped me on the shoulder. "Come on, Robert. Help me string it up." I tied the back legs of the pigoid while Donald tossed the other end of the rope over a tree branch. He looked down to check my work before starting to haul and did a double take.
"Whoa, that looks like one of Archimedes' weird knots. Where'd you learn that?"
"Oops. From Archimedes, of course. He's got hands and hands of different knots. I've picked up a few." Donald nodded, only mildly interested. We hauled on the rope until the pigoid was suspended. I made sure to use only normal Delton-level strength and let Donald do most of the work. Then he drew a flint knife and bled the animal. The other hunters started the giving thanks chant. When it was done, we trussed the carcass onto a couple of spears and started back to Camelot. There would be a feast tonight, and I loved barbecued pigoid. Still no barbecue sauce, though. I wondered idly if I should invent some. We were singing a victory chant, and I guess our guard was down. So the group of Deltons that stepped into the path in front of us took us completely by surprise. We came to a ragged halt as they tilted their spears in our direction. It wasn't quite a threat, more like the promise of one. I heard a rustling behind me and realized that we'd been surrounded. I took a quick look around. The other party outnumbered us by two. Not insurmountable, but definitely a concern. Very likely they were depending on getting the drop on us and us not being able to organize a defense. There had been reports of groups from Caerleon bushwhacking hunting parties and taking all or part of their kills. It appeared we were the target du jour. The spokesman for the group, I recognized him as an unpleasant character from Caerleon whose name translated as Fred, gave us an evil smile.
"Nice catch, Donald. You've got a lot of pigoid there. I doubt you'd miss a haunch or two."
Donald, unintimidated, raised his spear to readiness.
"There are lots of pigoids out there, Fred. What's the matter, not having any luck?"
Fred reflexively started to take a step back, then caught himself. Donald wasn't quite as big as his father, but that still left a lot of room for big. People rarely challenged him directly. Unfortunately for me, I was standing up front with Donald, and I had designed my android to be as nondescript as possible. Average height, average build, average looks. Joe forgettable, pretty much. So, no surprise that Fred decided to use me as an example. He looked at me.
"So, what about you, Kutsi? You think you'd like to share the wealth?"
He looked at his friends, smiling. They returned the expressions and moved in. "Tell you what, Fred," I answered. "Why don't you bend way over, stick your head up your own butthole, and keep pushing until you disappear completely?" I smiled at him as innocently as I could. Snickers and guffaws from our group, and a few from the other group, showed that I'd scored. Of course, I had gigabytes of Earth literature and movies to pull my insults from. In a war of words, the Deltans would be virtually unarmed. Donald gave me a quick, surprised glance. I guess he hadn't been expecting the support. He showed his teeth.
"Your move, pigoid dropping."
Fred glared at Donald, at me, then turned as if to leave.
"Oh, you have got to be kidding. Cliche much?"
And sure enough, he suddenly turned back and swung at me. I could have stopped and had afternoon tea and still reacted in time. Okay, I'm a computer, but still. I leaned back slightly and the clenched fist passed right by my face. As Fred continued the rotation, I placed a short jab in, well, in a human, it would be the solar plexus. Same effect, though. Fred said, "Oof," and dropped to his knees. Now their advantage was down to one. And we had Donald. Our guys grinned and started waving spear points. Donald and I moved forward and the other group stepped aside. As I passed Fred, he glared at me. I said, "Anytime, Kutsi." He didn't respond, but then he was still trying to breathe. There was a huge component of surrogate vengeance in my behavior, of course. I had a lot of years of being on the wrong end of bullying to look back on. But a rational part of my mind told me that I would have to watch out for Fred now. Donald slapped me on the back again. I made a point of staggering. I didn't want him to decide we were competing. We finished our hike to the village on high alert. No singing, no joking around. A couple of the guys took the kill to an agreed-upon fire pit to be divvied up. I turned to head back to Archimedes' tent, but Donald put a hand on my shoulder and motioned me to come with him. I realized within moments that we were heading for the council circle. One of the many universals that I discovered while studying the Deltans was that politicians and leaders always reserved the best for themselves. The council circle location got full sun first thing in the morning and was in the shade by late afternoon. A few council members were always at the circle, no doubt trying to look official and stay comfortable. Donald walked up to Jeffrey, the current council leader, and waited to be acknowledged. Jeffrey was a bit of a dick and liked to keep people waiting just to show how important he was. Donald accidentally stood in Jeffrey's sun and began cleaning his spear while he waited, the dried pieces of blood and hide landing all around Jeffrey. I looked around and tried to keep a straight face. Finally, Jeffrey accepted the fact that he was being out-ignored. He looked up and gestured for us to sit. We made ourselves comfortable, and Donald explained about our encounter with the Caerleon gang. When we were done, Jeffrey made a face.
"That's now almost a hand of encounters in the last three hands of days. A couple of people were stabbed when they refused to give up their kill. I'm going to have to bring this up with the full council. Something has to be done."
"All by people from Caerleon?" I asked.
"Yes. It looks that way. Leave it with me. I'll get the council started on it."
Donald nodded to Jeffrey and we got to our feet. As we walked away, I said to Donald, "Do you think it's the one gang or different ones?"
"Fred's been mentioned more than once. There might be others involved, but it's mostly him and his group."
"And all lately? What's changed?" Donald stared into space for a moment.
I don't think it's a case of something changing. It's more likely that Fred just saw a way to take advantage of something that's been brewing for a while. We're just not sure what's behind it."
We walked in silence for a few moments, while I thought through an idea. I looked up to Donald. I have a plan. Can we get an extra dozen people or so? People who won't mind some close-up action? Donald grinned.
Yeah, I think I can scrape that together.
I grinned back. Time for some dirty tricks, Earth style. 2. We've lost. Howard, February 2217, Vulcan. Bridget opened the door, looking surprised. I hadn't phoned ahead, and she wasn't expecting me tonight. She started to say,
Howard, what?
Then my expression must have registered.
Howard, what's wrong?
She grabbed my arm and dragged me into the apartment. We lost. We lost, and now a billion sentients are going to die. I collapsed onto her couch and leaned forward with my face in my hands.
The Pav?
I nodded, unwilling to trust my voice.
My God, Howard. Does Butterworth know? Are the Bobs all right?
I sighed and tried for calm.
We lost a lot of Bobs, but there are backups.
It's not quite the same, of course. I turned to Bridget and tried to smile reassuringly.
Riker let Dexter know, and Dexter will be passing the info along to Butterworth or whoever has taken over for him.
Are we in danger?
Not specifically, Bridget. The others only know about Earth and Epsilon Eridani. But there are almost 200 systems closer to GL-877 than us. All these worlds are ultimately in danger as long as the others exist.
And the Pav? I've read some of Jacques' blog entries. They sound like an interesting species. What happens to them?
I closed my eyes for a moment, hoping maybe I'd be in a different universe when I opened them. No such luck. We've never seen the process, just the after effects. Now we'll be getting a ringside view. The others will kill off all life on the Pav homeworld using the death asteroids, then move in with ants and cargo carriers, and strip the planet and the inner system of all metals. And they'll collect all corpses and carcasses. I had to stop and take a few deep breaths. The android body didn't need air, of course, but it was designed to react to emotion, and I was working myself up into a fine conniption. Jacques had a plan to rescue 20,000 Pav, but the rest will be dead soon. And the others will have wiped out another intelligent species, another entire planetary ecology. I turned on the couch to face her. There will be a moot today to try to figure out what we can do. I just wanted a few minutes. Bridget put her arms around me and pulled my head down to her shoulder. Soundlessly, I tried to cry without tear ducts. 3. Trouble brewing. Marcus, November 2212, Poseidon. I rubbed the bridge of my nose with thumb and forefinger, shaking my head. Cal waited patiently at the other end of the call. I looked up to see Gina smirking at me. She smoothed her features out quickly, but come on, computer, remember? I gave her a quick smile in reply.
Still not convinced, Marcus?
Cal cocked his head at me in the video window. I sighed. I guess I've been convinced for a while now, Cal. I just didn't believe it, you know? Cal laughed.
Thus ending the myth that computers are logical.
Bite me, I was human once. I sat back in my chair and considered my response. Spike picked that moment to jump into my lap for the obligatory chin scritching. I gave her the proper adulation while I thought through my options. Cal and Gina wouldn't even notice the millisecond pause in our conversation. Cal was an assistant governor on Southern Mat 3, and Gina was a mid-level security officer. I'd become friends with both of them over the last couple of years. As we became more comfortable with each other, they'd each confided an increasing concern about the Council's ongoing power grabs. Okay, so we'll take it as a given that the Council is no longer even pretending that they'll be instituting elections anytime soon, or at least not putting much effort into it. It's not proof positive of a totalitarian government, but I'll grant you it's a pretty good indicator. Gina likes to shoot things at the first excuse, but Cal, you're a lot more conservative. The fact that you've bought into this is what really scares me. Gina opened her mouth to retort, but Cal beat her to it.
Worst case, we're a long way from crossing any kind of line. If the council gets a sudden attack of sanity to the head, we'll have done nothing indictable, or even embarrassing. And yeah, Marcus, before we do anything that we can't take back, I'll want to take a good long look at the situation. I nodded, mollified. The Poseidon Administrative Council was happy to make use of my services, but I had no real official position or authority. The moment I became a liability, they could cut me loose. Not that I would be devastated by the snub. I wanted the colony to be self-sufficient, if for no other reason than so I could work on my projects in peace. "What do you need from me, Cal?" I asked. I've been steadily handing over functions to the administration for a decade now. If it came down to a showdown, I'm not sure I could even maintain control of the auto factories.
"If it comes to that," Cal responded, "you're a wild card, and something the council can't control or interdict. At minimum, you'll be a distraction. At best, you'll be able to cause them significant stress."
"Well, I always wanted to be a pain in the ass," I replied.
"Mission accomplished," Gina grinned at me. "But you're also a public figure and easy to track. We'll have to be careful about what you're seen doing."
"Hmm," I scratched my chin and thought. "There are a couple of things I can do about that, Gina. Let me work on it. And the public activity can be used as a red herring." I grinned at her.
"See, now you've got me doing it. Spies are us. Jeez."
We talked for a few more minutes, then ended the call. I sat back and stared into space, pondering my options. Like most nerds, I didn't take naturally to intrigue and double cross, but I could see some simple strategies that would make things a little more difficult for anyone trying to track me, not to mention an opportunity to make my pet project relevant. It might be time for a personal appearance. I leaned forward and placed a call to Howard. 4. Attitude. Howard, November 2217, Vulcan. I sat, slowly sipping my coffee, and watched the people go by. The mall was busy all the time, it seemed. But then Landing didn't have a whole lot of shopping malls. Okay, one. Original Bob had never had time for people watching and wouldn't have been caught dead sitting around doing nothing. Being immortal apparently put a different spin on things. Clothing shops, electronics shops, specialty shops selling things like bath products, it all made me feel both at home and nostalgic for home. The familiarity kept bumping up against the simple fact that I was 17 light years from Sol in a solar system that was originally the home of Mr. Spock, and on a planet that was destroyed in the movie reboot, but who's counting? Still, there was something about sitting at a table drinking coffee that made it all seem, well, mundane. Bridget would be along soon. I'd elected to wait for her here rather than tag along to the office and be underfoot. Meanwhile, I was enjoying the sensation of being just some random Joe.
"On my way now."
I smiled as I read the text in my heads up. We'd made a point of not planning anything specific today. Lunch, walking around. No big deal. Bridget showed up just as I finished the coffee. I stood, and we exchanged a quick kiss. She gave my hand a squeeze, then sat down.
"I'm starved. Want to try the food court for lunch?"
"Food court?" My eyebrows rose. "A liquor baroness should have more refined tastes. Let's splurge. How about the Bronto burger? Or we could go for actual food." Bridget gave me the evil eye.
"I happen to like Bronto burgers, I'll have you know."
"Bronto's it is," I declared. I stood, offered her my arm. Smiling, she stood and took it, doing a small curtsy. As we aimed ourselves in the general direction of the desired eatery, I heard a comment from a few tables away.
"Make sure you hold hands with Mommy."
The comment was offered sotto voce and may not have been intended for us to overhear, but the speaker, a zit-faced teenager, had miscalculated. I dug in my heels and turned to glare at him, and Bridget put her other hand on my arm.
"Howard, really? Consider the source."
I looked at the twerp who was grinning back at me, about 140 pounds soaking wet.
against an android with several times the reaction speed and strength of a human being. Not really a fair fight. I made a point of looking him up and down, then I laughed and turned away. I hoped he got the message. Bridget, meanwhile, was dragging me by the hand.
Food, this way.
Right you are. Let us go forth and dine on the flesh of the alien Bronto-like thing. We exchanged smiles and continued on our way, but the encounter bugged me. Bridget was now in her late 50s, biologically. The time spent in stasis during the voyage didn't count. I, on the other hand, was built to look like original Bob at 31, his age when he died in a Las Vegas intersection. The mommy comment was, unfortunately, mathematically plausible. But there was no way I would let Bridget be subjected to that kind of crap a second time. Age hadn't dulled Bridget's appetite at all. She dove into her burger and fries as enthusiastically as any teenager. I ate at a more refined pace, enjoying the flavor but not needing the sustenance. Technically, it was a waste of food, but I did this so seldom it hardly seemed worth worrying about. "How are the kids?" I asked her, as much to slow down the carnage as out of a desire to know. Bridget swallowed, wiped her mouth with a napkin, and glared at me. "You're not fooling me, bucko. You always wait until I have a mouthful." I grinned, unrepentant, and she continued.
"Rosie is... well, you've met Rosie. You know what she's like. She's entitled to her opinion, and you're entitled to her opinion as well."
Bridget took another bite of Bronto, frowning as she considered her next words.
"I think it's fair to say she doesn't like our relationship. It's not that she dislikes you personally, Howard. No more than she dislikes most people, I mean, but I think she'd prefer me to stay within my species. I've tried to talk to her about it, but, you know..."
I grinned at her. "There's Rosie's opinion, and then there's... well, no, actually, there's just Rosie's opinion."
"Yes, like that,"
Bridget chuckled.
"Well, I wanted my children to be self-reliant. Mission accomplished, I guess."
"I've talked to Howie a couple of times lately," I replied, nibbling at my fries. "He's a little more distant than he used to be. But I was ascribing that to him growing up and losing the hero worship."
"There's probably some of that, Howard. But there's a lot more of Rosie. She won't give it a rest."
I shrugged. "Look, Bridget, I've made it clear any number of times that you come first. If I create problems for your personal life or your professional life or your family life, I'm gone." Bridget put down the pitiful remains of her burger and leaned forward. She looked me straight in the eyes, my cue to shut up and pay attention.
"Howard, my relationships are my business. No one else gets a vote. I loved Stefan, and I've mourned him fully and properly. Now, I enjoy your company, and will continue to do so, despite a bitch of a daughter and some zit-faced mouthy mall rat. Do you have something you'd like to add?"
"No, dear." I grinned at her, and she rolled her eyes.
"Fine."
She cleaned up with the napkin and tossed it onto the mangled remains of her meal.
"Then let's go. I promised to get you some better clothes to drape on that android frame of yours."
"Threatened."
"What?"
"Threatened to get me better clothes." Bridget laughed and grabbed my hand to drag me off. Clothes shopping. Even death apparently wasn't an escape. 5. Bushwhacked. Bob, March 22, 24, Delta Eridani. We hoisted the pigoid carcass up, suspended from spears, doing our best to act oblivious to the other group that we knew were watching us. I checked the monitor windows in my heads-up display. We definitely had a covert audience, and they outnumbered us 12-6. I couldn't tell my crew things I shouldn't know, but I could be prepared in case the others did something unexpected. As we started our march back to Camelot, I couldn't help noticing that my crew were really, really terrible actors. Overly loud comments, uttered with exaggerated inflection, would have made a stage director up and quit on the spot. I needn't have worried, though. Fred and his gang probably weren't listening anyway. They stepped out, front and rear, just like last time. Fred looked at me standing in lead spot and smiled his nasty smile.
"Well, Robert, I see you've caught my lunch for me.
and you don't have the big guy to protect you today. Why don't you go ahead and put up a fight this time? I'd like that.
I cocked my head to the side. Well, first, Fred, Donald didn't need to protect me last time. You're just not very good. And if it's a fight you're looking for, today's your lucky day. And with that, 18 Camelot hunters, including Donald, stepped out of the bush behind Fred's gang. The Caerleon group went into a defensive crouch. Several of them tried to inch away and had to be poked with spear tips. In short order, we had them herded into a small group. Fred sneered at me.
You think this is going to protect you? You won't always have your friends around, Kutsi.
Neither will you, Fred. Fred jerked, taken aback.
What?
Just what I said. I can wait, and I can watch. And eventually, you'll go take a pee or something without your friends covering your ass. I leaned in close.
And I'll cut your throat before you even know I'm there.
I turned to the rest of the group. This goes for all of you. You go to war with us, you'll be watching your backs the rest of your lives. I never forget, and I never forgive. Fred laughed, a short, sharp bark.
Nice talk. Nothing behind it, though.
Really? I smiled at him, and before he could react, I jabbed him in the same place as last time. Down he went. It wasn't a fair fight, of course. I operated at computer speeds, and I was inhabiting an android body with electronic reflexes and several times the strength of a live Delton. But a fair fight wasn't the point. I wanted them to stop stalking Camelot hunting parties. I just needed to make their mortality clear to them. I looked around at the Caerleon gang. They appeared a lot less defiant now. Today, we'll let you off with a warning, and without your spears. Next time, it's going to hurt a lot more. I signaled to a couple of the guys, and they began collecting spears. Fred's gang was thoroughly cowed now and didn't put up any resistance. We sent them off, then turned to head back to Camelot. Donald walked beside me.
Damn, Robert. That was impressive. But I don't think Fred is that easily dissuaded.
You're right, Donald. But most of his followers will be. People like Fred need followers. I'm hoping this will pull his teeth. Donald nodded, then started up a marching chant, and everyone else joined in. I wished I was as confident as I sounded.
6. Launch. Bill, January 2223, Epsilon Eridani. Garfield shook his head in awe.
It's like those cartoon muscle cars when we were a kid. The ones that were all engine. The images in the video windows were indeed impressive. Epsilon Eridani 1, now in a completely new orbit around its sun, was surrounded by 800 mover plates. Trailing it by a million kilometers or so was one of the larger X-moons of Epsilon Eridani 3, with a similar array of plates. It had taken years to not only build all the equipment, but also to figure out how to control the assemblies. 40 supervisor AMIs were dedicated to maintaining and balancing the fields for each planet, in addition to the AMI in each plate. And overseeing each planet would be my latest clones. They'd named themselves Daedalus and Icarus, which I privately thought was a little pretentious. But hey, it's a free galaxy. Garfield looked at me, his face flushed with excitement.
Short-range test complete. There's a lot of room for error, but at minimum this setup is good for hundreds of Gs.
I smiled and leaned back in my chair.
I guess we're about ready then.
A quick ping to Day and Ick, and they popped into my VR.
Okay guys, everything checks out. You're clear that this is a Hail Mary, right?
The two nodded. Daedalus replied,
sure, but it's worth trying. Worst case, we fail, and the Bobs are no worse off.
It's a good opportunity to get some quiet time for some astrophysics work, too, Icarus added with a smile. I chuckled in reply.
Icky had turned out very similar to me in temperament. Content to leave the exploration and fighting to others, he just wanted to work on his research. I found myself a little ambivalent about Icarus and Daedalus. Cloning ourselves was always purposeful, of course, but I'd cloned these two for what could turn out to be a suicide mission. It felt unclean, somehow. They knew exactly what I'd been thinking when I'd made the decision to go ahead. The pair gazed back at me with alert interest, no trace of blame or rancor on their faces. I decided I'd accept their judgment. I hesitated, looking around the room. This was one of those moments that changed your life forever. Everything was ready to go. Time to fish or cut bait. Okay, guys. The docking bays are ready for your ships. Connect up, hit the road, and Godspeed. 7. Date. Howard. November 2217, Omicron Squared, Iridini. We walked out of the movie theater, arm in arm. Bridget looked as gorgeous as always. She turned and whispered in my ear, and as usual, my brain turned to mush.
You look very dignified, Howard, but you really didn't have to do that.
I shrugged. Modifying the android's appearance was a trivial operation. Avoiding a situation that might make Bridget uncomfortable was top priority. My apparent age now matched hers perfectly. Changing the subject, I said, that wasn't bad. There might be a future in this movie theater fad.
Yes, civilization has finally reached Vulcan. Next up, discos.
No. Please, no. There wasn't exactly a booming movie industry, of course. Vulcan was very much a frontier planet, and the economy was still bootstrapping through the basic requirements. We'd be another couple of decades before leisure activities became a major market segment. But Hollywood, and its various satellite locations and spiritual brethren, had produced thousands of movies of varying quality and popularity. And generally speaking, the holders of the copyrights were many light years away, and almost certainly quite dead as well. Someone in Landing eventually had the bright idea to open a local theater and play themed double bills. It was brilliant as far as I was concerned. And the general population, who had spent most of their previous lives in isolated, claustrophobic enclaves, were taking to the new medium with enthusiasm. Today's fare? A couple of zombie movies had been sold out. The audience was loud, opinionated, and mostly sneeringly amused, but no one left early. I leaned close.
I feel a hankering for brains.
Or sushi. Bridget laughed and opened her mouth to respond, but at that moment, her phone buzzed. 2 seconds later, I received an email from the coroner's office. I read the email in my heads-up display and stopped dead in my tracks. Bridget looked up from her phone, tears in her eyes.
Oh, Howard, no.
He left this note for you, Dr. Onagi said. He pushed an envelope across the desk to me, numbly, feeling like someone else was in control. I picked up the note and opened it. I held it so that Bridget could see.
Howard, I recently had occasion to visit the doctor, as I've been having issues with my memory and cognition. The news was less than pleasing. It would seem that I have a particularly nasty form of neurological degenerative dementia, one that is not curable. The doctor informs me that the process is already significantly advanced. I've contacted a few experts, and I was assured that this issue cannot be corrected in software. Under the circumstances, I don't see becoming a cognitively impaired replicant as an attractive option. My one remaining freedom is the ability to choose the manner of my passing. Howard, you've been a good friend over the years. Please don't think less of me for my decision. Sincerely, George Butterworth, Colonel USE, retired.
Bridget cried silently, tears running down her cheeks. I stared at Dr. Onagi. Numb.
How?
A neurotoxin. Painless and quick. Could he still be scanned? Dr. Onagi shook his head.
Even if it was medically possible, he had revoked consent.
I nodded and stood up. Thank you, Dr. Onagi. Bridget dried her eyes, stood, and followed me out of the office.
We still hadn't built the capability to cry into Manny the android. Too bad. I would have liked the release. Again, it might be time to bump up the priority on adding the capability. Although, it would be better if I just had fewer reasons to need it. We sat on Bridget's couch, arms wrapped around each other. Bridget had cried herself out. I would catch up as soon as she went to bed and I could return to VR. "People keep leaving," I finally said into the silence. Bridget looked up at me and I met her eyes. "I know it's normal. Your parents die. Grandparents. People who've been around all your life. Eventually, you die, and that's that. But when you're immortal, you're always on the receiving end. It's just one hit after another."
"But you meet new people,"
Bridget said, "and eventually they leave. After a while, I think you'd get gun-shy." I smiled at Bridget, a wan smile at best. I'm less standoffish than most Bobs, as a rule, but in this case, I think the others have the right of it. This gulf exists between immortals and what the Bobs are starting to refer to as ephemerals, for a reason. Bridget searched my face.
"Do you think of me as an ephemeral?"
"I think you're the most important thing in the universe, and that's the problem. Eventually, you'll die, and I'll be alone again." I sighed and stood. "I'm sorry, Bridget. I'm being a real dicky downer tonight. I think I should leave and let you get some sleep." Bridget grabbed my arm.
"Please don't. Just stay with me here. I don't want to be alone."
Without a word, I sat back down and put my arms around her again. She put her head on my shoulder and sighed. We sat there, quietly, not moving or talking. At some point, I realized that she'd fallen asleep, and that was fine, too.
8. Revolutionaries. Marcus, June 2214, Poseidon. For the third time, I raised my hand to knock and dropped it. I remembered Howard had mentioned a problem with stage fright the first time he'd gone out in public using an android. I wasn't sure if I hadn't believed him or just hadn't taken him seriously. Either way, someone owed someone an apology. And this would be my first public appearance with the new android form. After years of operating through video windows and telephone calls, I was finally going to meet my best friends on this world, face to face. If I could just manage to knock on the door. With a growl, I consciously set aside all my insecurities and rapped 3 times. The door opened immediately. I knew they'd been expecting me, but I had a sudden image of Cal waiting on the other side of the door with his hand on the knob, waiting for me to act.
"So, the great computer in the sky deigns to visit us poor mortals," he grinned down at me.
My android was the same height as original Bob, 6'1", but Cal towered over me, as he did over almost everyone. "Oh, bite me, Cal. Who's here already?" Cal stepped aside and motioned me in.
"Dinu and Gina. Vinny will be a bit late. He got caught up in some council thing."
I walked into the living room of Cal's small apartment. It was a constant source of frustration that on a planet with so much space, people were crowded into such concentrations. Granted, most of the planet was water, but there were enough mats, and now enough floating cities, so that people could spread out. The Council's insistence that everyone stay together had lately become a planet-wide source of contention. I wondered how much of that was natural, and how much was helped along by the rabble-rousers in this room. I sat down to find Gina and Dinu staring at me.
Dinu said, "Damn, that's impressive, Marcus. If I didn't know better, I wouldn't have given you a second glance. Completely believable."
I shrugged. "Several other Bobs have been working on the design for a couple of years now. I'm late to the party. Got my own priorities, you know." Gina and Dinu nodded, and Cal snorted. At that moment, there was a knock on the door, and Vinny walked in without waiting, wearing a furious expression. Clearly, the council thing had not gone well.
"Idiots! Morons!"
Vinny exclaimed. He grabbed a beer from the fridge, then threw himself down on the couch.
Come on in, Vinny. Grab yourself a brew, Cal said to him with a grin.
Vinny lifted the beer in salute.
Sorry. You know how it is with the council.
So?
Vinny popped the tab on the can while giving Cal the Spock eyebrow.
So? They have absolutely refused to consider any changes to their policies. They dismiss issues of public morale as fear-mongering. All I could get from them was a rote reiteration of their all-for-one standard speech.
Vinny paused and drained half the can.
Absent some kind of direct threat, they aren't budging. This is the future, folks.
Gina turned and looked at me.
So, big guy, I guess this is it. You said to exhaust all other avenues first. I think we've done that. It's time for a change of leadership. And since the council keeps putting off elections as low priority and a distraction, I'd say that's out the window as well.
I rubbed my forehead with one hand, then found myself gazing distractedly at my hand. The action felt significantly different than in VR, although I couldn't put my finger on exactly how. I shelved that thought for later when I had some free time. I looked at Gina, who was still waiting for an answer. I'll grant that you've gone through all your alternatives, but I don't think I have yet. Guys, I really do not want to become a revolutionary. People die in revolutions, even in the so-called peaceful ones. I looked around at the others, meeting their eyes one by one. I have the flying cities almost ready for the big reveal. I think that might shake things up enough without the need for shooting people and blowing things up.
Will you present that as a threat or keep it for a surprise?
Honestly, Cal, it's not really much of a threat, I replied. At least on paper.
Rethink your ways or we'll produce flying cities.
Lacks a certain something, know what I mean?
Cal chuckled ruefully. Okay, yeah, it may be more of a threat after it's implemented and we start to see some of the fallout. Until then, the council is only going to see what they want to see.
Still, you have to try. Dinu added. Present it to them, and if they don't get the point, oh well.
Gina went to the fridge and retrieved a beer. She waved it at Dinu before apparently realizing that was a bad idea with an unopened carbonated beverage.
Marcus's point, though, is that we'd like to avoid the full-scale revolution option, so oh well as an attitude is not helpful.
She turned to me.
And stop being such a wuss.
Dinu and I both grinned at her. Good old quiet, unopinionated Gina.
Okay. Cal looked around the room. So Marcus will go talk to the council and try to convince them that their totalitarian policy is not supportable. If they listen to reason, great. If not, we proceed on the cities thing anyway without official approval.
We each nodded silently. As plans went, it lacked something, but it was better than a shooting war.
Not acceptable!
Counselor Ben-Ben's face in the video window could only be described as thunderous. I tried to avoid grinning. To say that my proposal was meeting resistance would be a massive understatement. Counselor Murray cut in from another window.
We are finally getting close to aligning populations with labor requirements on the Matson cities. If people start moving around haphazardly or even emigrating to some other living arrangement, it will mean chaos. There aren't enough people to do all the required work. We need them to live where they're needed.
Leaving aside, I responded, the question of whether it's morally acceptable to tell people where they should live and what job they should do.
It's the law, Marcus.
I smiled at Counselor Brennan, which simply sidesteps the statement. Anything can be passed into law. That doesn't make it right. Plus, there's the question of the agreement you signed with Riker before we shipped you out here. It sets out that document is not legally binding, Brennan replied.
We've already voted on that.
So, you can just vote any agreement you don't like null and void on your own dime, then vote in whatever else you want. And everyone else is just supposed to go along because it's the law?
Murray looked down his nose at me. Really, literally.
Saying it with a sneer isn't a rebuttal, Mr. Johansson. I think we're pretty clear on this. No flying cities. Possibly at some point in the future, but we will make that decision, not you.
He looked around, likely gauging the mood of the other counselors from his end.
And I think we're done here. Good day.
And he switched off. Within a second or two, the other counselors did the same. I sat back in my office chair and shook my head.
Done?
Hardly. There was a scene in Demolition Man where the police captain couldn't conceive the possibility that someone might not follow orders. The council's reaction had that flavor. I sent a quick text to the Revolutionary Council, Cal, Dinu, and Gina. I tried. They dug in their heels. Looks like we'll be doing this the hard way. I didn't really want to bother Bill or Riker, or Bob, for that matter. They each had their own problems to deal with. I supposed that the others could eventually become my problem as well, but for now, I had the local issue to deal with. I checked my android's current location. I'd loaded it into a cargo drone after the meeting at Cal's and ordered the drone into orbit around Poseidon. I directed the drone to West Mat 4 with instructions to inform me when it arrived. The population of the mats hadn't really dropped much, yet. Only a few floating cities had been constructed and the council didn't feel the need to make them residential. Essential personnel and industry only. Yet another reason why the public was getting tired of the council. When we first decanted the colonists, there had been an expectation that living on the mats would be necessary for only a decade or so, maximum, and would be gradually phased out in favor of manufactured floating cities during that interval. Now, 20 years later, more than 90% of the human population of Poseidon still made their homes on the mats. I got a ping from the drone and smiled. After only a few days of having my own android, I found myself using any excuse to go walk about. It took only a moment to activate the android, and I found myself draped over the support rack. I opened the cargo doors and walked out into sunshine. Weather on the mats wasn't typically a problem. The colonists had made a point of settling mainly on the mats caught in the tropical zone. In the absence of any land whatsoever, Poseidon's oceans had settled into bands similar to Jupiter. Each band had a small but distinct difference in temperature, ecology, and even salinity. Rainstorms swept across the mats frequently, but they were mild, warm, and short. The occasional major storm could be seen developing days in advance, and a series of drones were in place to tow affected mats out of the way. I walked the short distance to the edge of the landing pad and joined pedestrian traffic. New Georgia was a small town by any measurement, and it exuded that flavor. People knew each other, no one seemed to be in a hurry, and there was no feeling of crowding, at least out in public. It was a measure of the perversity of human nature that the biggest complaint people had about living here was that they weren't given a choice. I sighed to myself and set off in a random direction. I didn't have a goal. I simply wanted to enjoy the day. It took fewer than 5 minutes for my day to be ruined. An internal buzz indicated an incoming call. Metadata showed it was from Cal. I connected, audio only. What's up, Cal?
The council apparently wasn't satisfied with just telling you no. They've taken steps.
Ooh, steps!
I snickered. What have they done?
Shut down anything that might be a source of supplies for us. Reallocated any personnel that might be helping and moved them, including Gina and Dinu. And changed all the printer schedules.
Gina and Dinu are going along with it?
Yes, he replied. There's no real point in digging in their heels right now. We'll just talk by phone a lot more.
I wonder if that's the point. I rubbed my chin and thought.
What?
Surveillance, Cal. If we're talking over the comms system, they might be monitoring.
Huh.
Cal was silent for a few moments.
And of course, if they pass a law, it's legal. And therefore ethical.
Something like that. And on that subject, we should probably hang this one up.
Gotcha. Coming over?
You got it, buddy. I'll be there in half an hour. I hung up the call, then checked my roamer inventory. If the council was willing to tap calls, they might be willing to plant bugs as well. Time to get serious.
What the?
Cal jerked back as he opened the door. I grinned at him, unrepentant. I had kept the roamers in my pockets on the walk over, but as we Bobs like to point out, we're not very mature. More than a dozen small roamers crawled over my clothing and one stood on my head doing a jig. Cal stepped aside, shaking his head.
You really are a bastard.
Chuckling, I ordered the roamers to sweep the room. This'll take only a minute or two. The roamers scampered down my body and scattered around the room. It took less than a minute to find 3 bugs. Cal and I looked at each other in stunned silence. It was one thing to talk about the possibility, quite another to discover the reality. A couple of roamers quietly destroyed the listening devices while their compatriots continued to search. In the end, they discovered only the 3. Cal let out a noisy breath.
Unbelievable. The lack of elections, the lack of free choice, and now this. We're definitely over the line into totalitarianism.
I'm going to leave a couple of roamers here to watch for further attempts, and I'll deliver some squads to everyone else's home. Gina will go ballistic, of course.
She's in security, Marcus. If she's being monitored and doesn't know about it, then she's out of the loop, and that doesn't bode well.
I shook my head. Consider the possibility that this is a regular thing, and she's just not high enough in the bureaucracy to know about it. That's sort of worse in a different way, of course.
Cal waved off the comment. Yeah, fine. Now, flying cities.
Given the council's reaction at my meeting with them, I think just introducing the cities will be provocative enough, I replied. And if not, if they do nothing, we win by default.
And for now, we just lie low?
I nodded. The fun will come to us, I think. I pulled an item out of my backpack. Meanwhile, here's our new communication system. Scut tech, encrypted, and infested with nanites. If someone tries to dick with it, they'll get a nasty surprise. Cal took the device, carefully touching it only with the ends of his fingers. I laughed at his obvious discomfort. Come on, buddy, give me some credit. The nanites will recognize attempted tampering. You're fine. He shrugged and gave me a lopsided grin.
Dinu and Gina getting the same thing?
I nodded. No matter what we do, the phone system won't be secure. We can't protect it end to end. Cal sighed and placed the comm unit on his desk.
Remember that line I said we hadn't crossed?
I nodded. I can see it in my rear view mirror. We are now officially revolutionaries. Yeehaw. 9. Tension. Howard. February 2218, Vulcan.
You should leave my mother alone.
I'd been casually examining a storefront display at the mall, so the comment coming out of nowhere made me jump. I turned around to find Rosie, Bridget's eldest daughter, glaring at me.
What?
Oh, great. Come back, Howard. Brilliant.
You're a machine. You're not even human. My mother needs to get over the death of my father and move on, but not with a machine.
Here we go. My fertile and somewhat anxiety-ridden imagination had pictured something like this. I wasn't particularly happy about the validation. Rosie, the two aren't mutually exclusive. I, the real me, am human.
I, spare me all the scientific double talk. You're a recording of a human. I'm not interested in debating the issue.
Then why are we even talking?
What?
Rosie blinked rapidly and drew back slightly. I seemed to have managed to derail whatever speech she was gearing up to. I noted out of the corner of my eye that we were attracting an audience. Several passers-by had stopped to watch the drama, and at least one person had their phone out. I wondered if I qualified as a celebrity. Rosie, I continued, trying to ignore the gawkers. You may not be interested in a debate, but I'm equally not interested in standing here being lectured at. To coin a phrase that was around when I was young, you're not the boss of me. And more to the point, I think your mother is freely choosing to associate with me.
And I've told her exactly what I think of that.
Rosie was almost spitting the words.
But you've gotten her all twisted around.
Oh, freaking hell, I exclaimed, rolling my eyes.
Have you met your mother?
Have you ever tried to get her to do something she didn't want to? I waved a hand dismissively. Look, I don't want to get into a confrontation with you. Mostly out of respect for your parents, both of whom I love and loved dearly. But Bridget is an adult and able to make her own decisions. I'll stop seeing her when she says so. You don't get a vote. And that was it. We stood there glaring at each other. Any hope of discussion or understanding pretty much skewered, possibly permanently. After a few more moments of impasse, Rosie sneered at me and wordlessly stalked off. Well, isn't that just peachy? I looked around at the small crowd that had gathered. No one would meet my eyes, and they swiftly dispersed. I resumed my aimless wandering, trying to get back into the window shopping mood, but couldn't put Rosie out of my mind. And some of the looks from my erstwhile audience had been hostile. Obviously, I had been recognized. I began to wonder what I would do if this drama spilled over onto Bridget. We were sitting on Bridget's couch while I recounted my earlier experience at the mall.
I didn't tell you because it isn't your problem, Howard.
Bridget looked sad, but not apologetic.
My kids, mostly Rosie, I think, would like to see me dating someone less, biologically challenged. She started lecturing me on the subject whenever I see her. Leanne and Howard mostly stand around looking uncomfortable.
Wonderful. Is there anything else you aren't telling me? She smiled at me.
Well, there is a certain amount of gossip going around. Some of the more interesting items involve questions about your equipment, so to speak.
I couldn't help it. I started to laugh helplessly. Thanks to the very authentic proprioceptive circuits in the android, I had to sit down or risk falling over. For maybe the 10th time, I made a note to myself to install tear ducts. Bridget grinned, sharing the moment.
And on that subject...
Oh, no, you don't. I've already told you that I'll upgrade Manny any time you say the word. That's on you. Now Bridget was laughing, too. The hilarity fed back on itself until we were both lying back on the furniture, gasping for breath and whooping helplessly. Finally, after a minute or two, we both managed to recover control. Bridget took my hand.
And that's one of the reasons why I love you. Even Stefan often just looked at me like I had a screw loose. I had to bite back a lot of my more lowbrow humor. With you, well, you get it.
Minds together in the gutter forever. I smiled at her.
My God. She was beautiful.
The internet hadn't really changed that much in 200 years. Oh, there were new companies and old companies had gone out of business. A lot of the jargon had changed, but people were still people and still had the same interests. There were still forums. You could still follow someone. Everyone still had a personal landing page on any of several different platforms. And blogs were still popular. Apparently, narcissism and voyeurism were still alive and well. The point, though, was that it didn't take a lot of effort to track down some commentary relating to the locally famous, or perhaps infamous, replicant. My android persona wasn't any kind of a secret and had become a small but persistent topic of conversation, and there were enough pictures posted to make me recognizable if someone cared enough. There was no shortage of opinions on the subject, although they appeared to be about evenly split. I was either some kind of Frankenstein's monster, or I was just some guy who had the same right to exist as everyone else. There didn't really seem to be any middle ground. It looked like my relationship with Bridget was the real sticking point. Most people were okay with me just wandering around visiting malls and such, but they drew the line at me dating outside my chemical family. It was unlikely that Bridget was unaware of this. That meant she was protecting me. Crap. I was just chauvinistic enough to want to be the one doing the protecting. I wondered if she had a plan.